Hello, everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Thursday, April 22nd. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Glad to have you listening, as always. Having a beautiful, slightly breezy day in Fort Dodge, as I read for Iris. And we have some good weather coming our direction. I think the worst of the cold weather is over for now. So we'll take a more detailed look at the forecast as we conclude our time together. Residents of Clare are advised to boil water before using it for cooking or drinking due to the painting project at the water tower. This boil advisory will go in effect at 6 o'clock today, meaning Thursday, and will continue until further notice. One Step Ahead is the title of the next article. School doesn't stop for Maddie Major, a senior at Fort Dodge Senior High. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, she kept up on all of her high school classes, whether online or face-to-face, and during the summer she completed courses through Iowa Central Community College. Now that hard work is paying off for the 18-year-old. Major is graduating with her Associate of Arts degree from Iowa Central. The college is holding its graduation virtually tonight. The Fort Dodge Senior High graduation is May 23rd. The pandemic has been crazy, she said, and it really slowed a lot of my life. I was a junior, so I was prepping for the ACT. I was starting spring sports, and those had been canceled. But Major stayed focused on her academics. It was kind of a good thing I was taking college classes and summer classes because it gave me something to do and be productive when we couldn't leave the house or do much of anything, she said. Throughout high school, Major has been involved with orchestra, golf, swim team, National Honor Society, and Ambassador Society. Major has spent most of her life in Fort Dodge. Her family moved here in 2006 from Chillicothe, Missouri, where she was born. Outside of school, she attends First United Methodist Church. She also takes private music lessons from Melissa Gillette. Music, particularly playing the violin, is one of her favorite hobbies. I started playing the violin in fifth grade, like most kids, when they say, okay, you play an instrument now, Major said. I listened to a lot of classical music, and I thought it was the most interesting. It turns out to be one of the hardest instruments to learn. I like the challenge, even though it drives me crazy sometimes. Major said she's getting better. Sometimes when I practice, I don't think I'm even halfway decent, she said. With music, you are always learning, and I think I'm just getting better every time I practice. She enjoys time spent with her parents and grandparents. Every summer, she and her brother Brady raise sweet corn with their grandparents in Albia. The sweet corn they sell is money to be used for college. Major's next move is to attend Iowa State University in Ames, where she plans to major in chemical engineering. There's a lot of different fields I can go into with chemical engineering, she said. I could go into agriculture or oil or biofuels or pharmaceuticals and work on something like a COVID-19 vaccine. Graduating college and high school simultaneously took planning and focus. First started when I was in eighth grade, she said. The daughter of my social studies teacher had done the same thing. I thought that was cool. In eighth grade, we were making our high school schedule. I made it a goal of mine to try to challenge myself while still taking classes that I love, like orchestra and Spanish and other activities like that. All the classes she took met high school course credits and earned her credits at Iowa Central. Over the summer, I took strictly Iowa Central courses, Major said. So for about 8 to 10 weeks of summer, I was still in school. She's had fun with all of her high school activities. Her mom inspired her to try golf. My family was really into golf, Major said. My mom golfed in high school. I had been around golf courses a little when I was younger. I wanted to try and golf in high school, and that's when I really started playing. It's been quite a lot of fun playing with the high school team. In terms of swimming, Major has been in the pool since she was about 6. I always loved to do swimming, and my parents made it a very high priority for me to learn to swim when I was young. I would go to the rec a lot, but the swim team was always using the bigger pool. I joined them one day and never stopped. I joined the Fort Dodge swim team, which then went on to be ACAC, the Ames Cyclones Aquatics Club in Fort Dodge. Achieving a personal best time in swimming and having all of her friends there is just one example of the experiences she cherishes from high school. One of the proudest moments was when the high school orchestra earned its first Division I rating. That was really cool to be a part of, she said. making a model of a city in Andy Adams' class is a project she won't soon forget. One of my favorite things we did was sophomore year, Miss Adams' class, we basically made a whole model off the book, The House on Mango Street, we were reading at the time. We basically made a whole city. She said they took an old poster board and built tiny models of houses made up of cardboard or ice pop sticks. It was creative and collaborative, Major said. In Fort Dodge, she said everyone cares about each other here. Major said she reaches her goals and stays consistent because she enjoys what she's doing. Really, I enjoy all of it, and once I set my mind to it, I'm going to do it, she said. So I find a way. I find joy in all of it. If I didn't like it, I wouldn't do it. From our files, shows a picture of outgoing Fort Dodge Correctional Facility Warden Jerry Burt, who watches with new Warden Cornell Smith as they hold a ceremonial key to the facility as the color guard retires the colors at the end of the change of leadership ceremony. That is from our files, April 2006, 15 short years ago. News of record, Fort Dodge police logs from Tuesday report one domestic call, a suspicious vehicle, 1600 block 9th Avenue South. Theft, 2700 block North 13th Street. Suspicious vehicle, 2300 block 6th Avenue North. Car accident, 200 block South 25th Street. A car accident, 1700 block 5th Avenue South. A runaway, 200 block of Avenue M West. Suspicious person, 1000 block South 25th Street. Theft, 600 block Central Avenue. Trespassing, 500 block of North 15th Street. A runaway, 400 block South 14th Street. Theft, 700 block 1st Avenue South. An assault, 3,000 block of 5th Avenue South. Loud music, 400 block North 27th Street. A burglary in progress, 1900 block 3rd Avenue North. Juvenile problems, 2700 block 19th Avenue North. Car accident, 1200 block of 4th Avenue South. And in the 100 block of Kenyon Road. Loud music, in the 600 block of South 18th Street. Magistrate Court on Wednesday, voluntary absence from custody, Harley Llewellyn of Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing April 30th, willful injury causing bodily injury, Nash Wheaton of Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing April 30th, failure to appear at arraignment, Joey Gill of Fort Dodge, 3 counts transferred to district court, violation of the sex offender, Registry, Joey Gill, preliminary hearing set for April 30th. Disorderly conduct, Jonathan Wolf of Goldfield, fined $180.75. Driving under suspension, Brittany Scoland of Fort Dodge, fined $433.75. Medical examiner from the Al Henderson murder trial taking place in Davenport testified that Reverend Henderson died from strangulation and blunt force trauma. The Reverend Al Henderson died as a result of blunt force trauma to the head along with strangulation, according to the medical examiner who conducted his autopsy. Iowa State Associate Medical Examiner Dr. Michelle Cattelier testified about those results during the jury trial for Josh Pendleton at Scott County Courthouse on Wednesday. Pendleton is charged with first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. Cattelier conducted Henderson's autopsy at the Iowa State Medical Examiner's office in Ankeny on October 3, 2019, the day after Henderson was allegedly assaulted and killed by the defendant. On Wednesday, she identified a photo showing deep purple bruising around Henderson's right eye and pointed toward areas on the eyeball and eyelid where she found petechia, tiny blood hemorrhages, often consistent with strangulation. Petechia is one of the hallmarks of strangulation, but can also be caused by blunt force trauma, she said. Cattelier also showed the jury photos of bruising and hemorrhaging on several places of Henderson's neck, including on his larynx, also consistent with strangulation. She noticed a mark in the shape of a line several inches long across the neck that was consistent with strangulation and suggests that some tool or implement was used. It is a line that is very regular, she said. During the autopsy, Cattelier found bruising and several curved injuries on Henderson's face. On the left side near the left eye and eyebrow, there was what she called a complicated injury. It includes two lacerations or tears that are side by side and the top part of the injury has scraped the skin away. The skin is piled up on the bottom side of the injury, she said. The injury was consistent with a bite mark, the medical examiner testified. Fractures were found on several of Henderson's ribs, Cattler said, adding they could have been caused by inflicted or accidental injury or even compressions during resuscitation attempts. The medical examiner also testified to finding several severe hemorrhaging, on the back of Henderson's head and on his brain, consistent with blunt force trauma. The jury also listened to testimony from Fort Dodge Police Department evidence technician Brandy Webb and viewed pieces of physical evidence, including a rope found at the scene of the crime and the clothing Pendleton was wearing when he was arrested. Webb noted that the rope had a metal clasp and was looped through the clasp when it was collected. Defense attorney Michelle Wolf asked why there was no loop in the rope when it was returned from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Lab and objected to the rope being entered as evidence on the grounds that the chain of evidence was not properly maintained. District Court Judge Gina Batting overruled the objection, and later DCI forensic investigator Brenda Reinhard testified on the issue. Reinhard testified that she looked for the presence of blood on four areas of the rope and took swabs of the entire rope, stating that she had to unloop the rope to lay it lengthwise in order to swab it. Reinhard said she did not find any presence of blood on the rope, but she was able to find DNA from at least two individuals, though there was not enough DNA present to build a profile and compare it to any known sample. Reinhard also processed blood and DNA evidence found on Henderson's fingernails, building a partial DNA profile consistent with DNA from Pendleton. She also swabbed the area of Henderson's right eyebrow and found more of Pendleton's DNA. The jury watched and heard body camera footage from then Sergeant Josh Pyle, a jailer at the Webster County Jail. The recording came from when Fort Dodge Police Department Sergeant Evan Thompson executed the search warrant on Pendleton's person, taking swabs and photos of Pendleton's injuries. "The funny thing is, my elbows," Pendleton can be heard saying. "We wrestled on concrete for at least 5 minutes. I bit his face and his head. I pulled his thorn bush out with my teeth." Pendleton can also be heard asking if it was possible to get DNA off of fingernails and instructing the officers to swab his fingernails. "You'll find his DNA right there," he said. Pendleton starts saying something about feeling Henderson's eyeball, but some of the audio was inaudible. Pendleton continues making unprovoked statements during the recording. "He did a weird thing," he said, "like he stuck his tentacle in my mouth right here. That's where he stuck it." At one point, Pyle asked Pendleton if he wanted to take a shower before he changed into the jail uniform. "I showered," Pendleton said. "I didn't want his piece of blank stink all over me." Pendleton also repeated the phrase, "that man about killed me," several times, not specifying to whom he was referring. Pendleton could also be heard joking around with Pyle and made comments about Detective Larry Headland, calling him a, quote, "dirty detective and bad lieutenant." Defense attorney Michelle Wolf cross-examined Pyle, asking if he had heard Pendleton make any statements that seemed unusual. "He had several statements that seemed unusual to me," said Pyle. Pyle also testified that he knew of Pendleton as someone with mental health issues and had not heard him use the strange accent that he was speaking in that night before. Wolf also asked Pyle about an incident that occurred at the jail on October 14, 2019. "Do you recall Mr. Pendleton saying something to you on that day to the effect of, 'I'm innocent in the sense that what I did was justified'?" she asked. Pyle answered that he did remember and that he had made a report about the incident. While cross-examining Thompson, Wolf asked if he had conducted a full and fair investigation, including seeking exculpatory evidence that may provide possible defenses to the crime. "I believe so, yes," Thompson answered. Wolf asked about the 24 individuals Thompson interviewed during the investigation, including the defendant's mother, Heidi Pendleton. Thompson testified he interviewed Heidi Pendleton to see if the defendant had talked to her the day of the crime and to determine if the defendant owned a cell phone. Wolf said that Heidi Pendleton had brought up the defendant's mental health history and specific incidents she had with the defendant during the interview. "Did you make any attempt to corroborate what she told you? Wolf asked. Thompson said he had followed up on information gathered from Heidi Pendleton, but did not specify what information he had followed up on. Wolf continued asking if Thompson had looked into any prior contact the defendant had with police that Heidi Pendleton had brought up. Thompson indicated he reviewed previous calls for service regarding the defendant, including law enforcement, serving mental health papers to him, but he did not find that information relevant to the investigation into Henderson's death. Josh Pendleton's trial will continue on Thursday with testimony from Hedlund, who interviewed the defendant after he was arrested. The death of a 17-year-old girl who was found unconscious at a hog site building is under investigation, according to the Kossuth County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff's deputies and Sway City Ambulance were called to 407 390th Street in rural Sway City on Monday for a person who was unconscious. When first responders arrived sometime after 9:10 p.m., Victoria Marie Parra-Lurdo of Rockwell City was found lying on the floor. It was reported she was assisting in the cleaning and power washing of the facility. Parra-Lurdo was pronounced dead at Kossuth County Regional Health Center. The Iowa Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny will be conducting an autopsy to determine the cause of death. The investigation is ongoing. An Algona man accused of shooting a short-barreled shotgun at another person in Rolfe will spend the next 4 years on probation after receiving a 10-year suspended prison sentence. District Court Judge Christopher Polking handed down the sentence at the Pocahontas County Courthouse Monday after defendant Joshua J. Schmidt pleaded guilty to going armed with intent, a Class D felony, and possession of a short-barreled shotgun, a Class D felony. Schmidt was also sentenced for a third offense after pleading guilty to escape from custody, a Class D felony. For the two charges stemming from the shooting, Schmidt received two suspended 5-year prison sentences. He must serve 2 years of probation for each to be served concurrently. He will have to live in a residential facility for 180 days. His $2,472.50 in fines were also suspended. For his charge of escape from custody, Schmidt received a 5-year suspended sentence and a $1,236.25 suspended fine. For his suspended sentence in this charge, Schmidt will have to serve 2 years probation to be served consecutively with his other sentences. In September 2020, the Pocahontas County Sheriff's Office was dispatched to 102 Grant Street in Rolfe for a reported shooting at the residence. The victim and witnesses identified the alleged shooter by clothing worn at the time as Schmidt, age 18. On the evening of September 12th, the defendant shot one shell from a short-barreled 20-gauge shotgun at the victim, but missed the target before fleeing on foot. The victim was not injured. Schmidt was taken into custody on September 14th after an exhaustive search and booked into the Pocahontas County Jail on a $25,000 cash bond. He was originally charged with attempted murder, a Class B felony, going armed with intent, possession of a short-barreled shotgun, and assault while displaying or using a dangerous weapon, an aggravated misdemeanor. On November 21, 2020, while being held at the Pocahontas County Jail, Schmidt and another inmate escaped the jail floor through the fire escape. Both inmates were located and arrested a short time later. For this offense, Schmidt was charged with escape from custody and conspiracy to commit non-forcible felony, a Class D felony. In his sentencing order, Polking said he took into account the defendant's criminal history, circumstances surrounding the crime, and other factors when determining the sentence. Schmidt did not have a prior criminal history of violent offenses. The most serious of his previous charges was possession of drug paraphernalia, a simple misdemeanor. A Fort Dodge man has pleaded guilty to methamphetamine conspiracy and illegal weapons charges in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Iowa. Daniel Moss, 45, pleaded guilty to conspiracy to distribute meth and the illegal possession of a firearm on Monday. Moss admitted to conspiring to distribute more than 50 grams of pure meth in the Fort Dodge area between June 2020 through July 5, 2020. On July 5th, he was involved in a hit-and-run collision with another vehicle, fled the scene, and led Fort Dodge police officers on a pursuit. Officers caught Moss that same day, and he assaulted a police officer, and a loaded handgun fell from his waistband. The firearm was later determined to be stolen. Moss had discarded a black sports duffel bag and $2,500 in cash as he fled the accident scene. The search of the bag revealed a drug ledger, paperwork with Moss's name, syringes, baggies with residue, a scale, a cell phone, approximately $14,500, and approximately 2 grams of meth. In Moss's abandoned vehicle, officers found another bag containing 54 grams of pure meth, a scale, and a pipe used for ingesting controlled substances. Moss has a prior felony conviction, a federal felony conviction, for conspiracy to distribute meth, distribution of meth within a protected location, and use of a person under 18 to assist in the conspiracy to distribute meth. His conviction prohibited him from possessing a gun. Moss faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years in prison, with a possible life sentence and a $20 million fine for the new meth charge. For the firearm charge, he faces up to 10 years in prison and a fine of $250,000, or up to $250,000. Moss remains in custody of the United States Marshal, pending sentencing. We'll take a look next at the Messenger editorial. Today is Earth Day. It's a good day to commit to preserving a livable environment. The late 1960s were turbulent years in America. It was a time of rapid change when young protesters expressed disillusionment with many aspects of the world their elders had built. The divisions in society that emerged from those conflicts decades ago still haunt our society in the 21st century. Some of the emotional scars from those bitter disputes will influence American politics well into the future. There is, however, one legacy of those chaotic times that unites rather than divides us: Earth Day. The first Earth Day was April 22, 1970. Today marks 51 years of Earth Day. It came about as the result of growing public concern about protecting and improving the environment. Then Senator Gaylord Nelson, a Democrat from Wisconsin, hit on the idea that using one day each year as a focal point for expressing concern about the environment. The goal was to bring together various environmental activists to protest bad policies and advocate initiatives that would make the planet an increasingly hospitable home, not only for mankind, but for all living things. A good deal of progress has been made since 1970 in bringing us closer to that goal. The nation's air in many parts of the United States is much cleaner than it was in 1970. Our water is also cleaner. Many lakes, harbors, and rivers are less polluted today than they have been in a century. Good progress also has been made in reversing the loss of wetlands. Government and private sector initiatives to clean up and restore polluted industrial sites have turned many dangerous eyesores into more acceptable venues. Here in Fort Dodge, the Messenger is among many local businesses committed to protecting the environment. More than 150,000 pounds of newsprint are recycled each year. 1 ton of recycled paper saves 17 trees and 7,000 gallons of water. Additionally, more than 7,000 pounds of cardboard are recycled annually, as well as in excess of 10,000 pounds of aluminum from plates used in the printing process. According to industry estimates, aluminum recycling can result in a 95% savings in energy usage. In 2021, concern about the environment has become a mainstream issue with its widespread support from people across the political spectrum. There are disagreements, particularly regarding particular policies, and occasional quarrels about the scientific justification for certain approaches. That should not, however, obscure a very basic fact. We all have an enormous stake in keeping our home planet livable. Earth Day 2021, which is celebrated today, remains an important symbol of our commitment to that goal. And that is today's Messenger editorial. There's a column entitled Support Needed for College and Career Exploration. This is written by Emily Shields. As we recover from COVID-19, Iowa is confronted with many challenges, among them a growing workforce shortage and declines in higher education enrollment. The percentage of high school graduates pursuing education or training beyond high school has declined for 3 years in a row for the first time in history. At the same time, the demand for skilled workers to fuel economic expansion greatly exceeds the number of people with the skills to fill open positions. There are many facets to these dual problems. One of them is a lack of guidance and support for high school students considering their college and career options. Research has shown that many school counselors are key to a successful transition to post-secondary education and training. Their influence is especially significant for low-income and first-generation college students who may not have guidance available at home. Unfortunately, caseloads and mental health needs do not always allow for counselors to play this role. Iowa's average ratio is one counselor for 418 students, and while that is below the national average, it is much higher than the 250 or less recommended by the American School Counselor Association. As a part of the solution, the Iowa Association of Community College Trustees, alongside all 15 community college presidents, have proposed the rapid expansion of the state's College and Career Transitional Counselors Program, known as CCTC. 4 counselors have been hired so far, and funding was recently awarded for 13 more. The position shared between community colleges and one or more high schools and assist Iowa high school students in exploring college options to prepare for available careers. The CCTC model of shared positions between high schools and community colleges has demonstrated success on a limited scale in increasing the number of Iowa high school graduates pursuing and succeeding in education and training beyond high school. It is time to invest state and federal resources in bringing the CCTC model to more areas of the state, and we have requested federal community project funds to do so. Governor Kim Reynolds, the Iowa Department of Education, the Iowa Business Council, the Iowa Association of Business and Industry, and Iowa Workforce Development have signed on to support this request along with school superintendents statewide. These funds would allow for counselors to be hired in every community college district in the next year and reach thousands of students in need of support to understand their education and training options and take steps to preparing for high-quality, high-paying jobs. And this is a column provided by Emily Shields, who serves as Executive Director of the Iowa Association of Community College Trustees, a statewide association dedicated to the success of Iowa's 15 community colleges, their students, staff, faculty, and communities. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind, and now we will turn to today's obituary page. Walter Gates. Walter Gates, 90, passed away peacefully with his children by his side on Friday, April 16th at Iowa Methodist Medical Center. No services are planned at this time. Laufesweiler Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Born April 22nd, 1930 in Greenwood, Mississippi to William and Bertie Gates, he is survived by his children Walter Lynn Gates, Mark Gates, Annette Gates, and Pam Hamrick. He is also survived by 7 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by the love of his life, Jeanette Gates, parents William and Bertie Webb Gates, brothers Robert, F.M., and Percy. As a young man, Walter determined to make a better life for himself, fled rural Mississippi as part of the Great Migration to the North. He arrived in Fort Dodge in 1951. It was there at a Saturday night YWCA dance that he observed a single young lady dancing in the corner to the sounds of Count Basie. That young lady, Jeanette Patterson, later became his wife. Together they were blessed with 4 children. Walter worked hard all of his life to provide opportunities for his family that he didn't have as a child. He was an honest and loving father who led by examples of determination, hard work, and respect for others. Those who loved him will sadly miss him. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Oscar Esklund. Oscar S. Esklund, 93, of Fort Dodge, died Tuesday, April 20th at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. A service honoring Oscar's life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, April 24th at Grace Lutheran Church with the Reverend Dan Call officiating Interment will be in North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation is 10 to 10:45 a.m. Saturday at the church. Memorials may be directed to the discretion of the family. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Oscar is survived by his wife, Darlene, his son, Cal Askeland, daughters-in-law, Liz Askeland and Laura Askeland, 7 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his sons, Rod and Brian, his siblings, Sarah, Helen, Elmer, Mary, George, Agnes, and Inez. Oscar Severin Askeland, the son of Ed and Edna Askeland, was born December 17, 1927, in Thor. He attended country school near Thor and later proudly earned his GED through Iowa Central. In 1952, Oscar was united in marriage to Darlene Einan at Palmer. Oscar farmed for a short time and later worked at Chantlin Engineering at Humboldt. Oscar enjoyed woodworking, yard work, and collecting model John Deere tractors. He liked to play cards, go bowling, and was an avid Iowa Hawkeye fan. Oscar treasured time spent watching his grandchildren in their activities. Ronald J. Wetter. From Rockwell City, Ronald J. Wetter, 81, died Tuesday, April 20th at his home. Memorial services are 11 a.m. Saturday, April 24th at St. Francis Catholic Church in Rockwell City. Visitation is 9 a.m. Saturday at the church until service time. Masks are required. The service will be live-streamed on the Palmer and Swank Funeral Home Facebook page. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Palmer and Swank Funeral Home in Rockwell City is in charge of arrangements. Ronald is survived by his wife Janice, children Kimberly Wetter, Kathy Card, Tony Wetter, and Tracy Wetter, 4 grandchildren, Spencer Clausen, Jasmine Carroll, Savannah Card, and Joseph Ronald Wetter, 2 great-grandchildren, Lux Clausen and Crew Clausen, sisters Annette Pierce, Marlene Reed, brother Paul Wetter, nieces, nephews, other relatives, and friends. He was preceded in death by his son Timothy, parents Clarence A. and Marie Powers Wetter, brothers Richard and Larry Wetter, sister-in-law Patricia Wetter, and brother-in-law Gerald Mike Reed. Ronald Jerome Wetter was born December 29, 1939 at Rockwell City, graduated from Cedar Valley High School in 1957, and attended Fort Dodge Community College. He worked at Gypsum Mills and Kalo Brick and Tile in Fort Dodge. On July 29, 1961, he was united in marriage to Janice Dana at St. Francis Catholic Church in Rockwell City. The couple had 5 children born to this union. In 1971, they made their home on the Wetter Century Farm. Ronald spent a majority of his life doing what he loved, farming. One of his greatest joys was watching his children and grandchildren at their sporting events and activities. He especially loved to tell people about how proud he was of their accomplishments. He was looking forward to watching his great-grandchildren and their activities. Ronald was an active member of St. Francis Catholic Church. Victoria Maria Parra Lurdo. From Rockwell City, services for Victoria Marie Parra Lurdo will be 2 p.m. Sunday at the South Central Calhoun High School Gymnasium in Lake City. Visitation is 4 to 7 Saturday at the Palmer and Swank Funeral Home in Rockwell City. From Webster City, Carol Doc Hollingshead. Carol Doc Hollingshead, 97, of Webster City, joined the Angels on Monday, Thursday, April 1st, 2021, surrounded by his children at their family home. Celebration of Life will be held at 1:30 on Thursday, May 13th, at the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Webster City. Foster Funeral and Cremation Center is in charge of arrangements. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. We'll head over next to the Messenger sports section. The first article, Elite Expectations, Messenger Land Athletes Have High Hopes, is the title. As a freshman, Kirsten Fisher made a statement at the Drake Relays in her final season at Southeast Valley. The Jaguar senior hopes to leave it all on the track again at the Blue Oval. Fisher, who competed here during both her freshman and sophomore campaigns, will be in the 100-meter hurdles and the high jump on Thursday inside Drake Stadium. The future University of Iowa Hawkeye already has a silver medal in the high jump from Drake, clearing 5 feet 6 inches during her rookie season. In return, as a sophomore, she was 19th in the high jump and 30th in the 100 meters hurdles. After going to Drake my freshman year, it became a goal of mine to qualify for Drake every year, she said. So when it was canceled in 2020, I was very devastated. It made it that much more exciting, though, when I qualified this time around. After not being able to compete due to the pandemic, Fisher is excited to get back to the Drake Relays. For my senior year, I am extremely grateful that I am able to have a track season and compete one last time, Fisher said. Fisher enters with the fifth best qualifying jump at 5 feet 4. She is 24th in the 100-meter hurdles. As a sophomore at State, Fisher won the high jump, was second in the 100-meter dash, and placed 8th in the 110-meter hurdles. Humboldt's Kendall Clark and West Bend Mallard's Rachel Fear will also be returning to Drake Stadium. It's a great feeling to be back after expecting a season and not having one last year. I've just kept working on it to get to this point, Clark said. I'm trying to get my footwork better. It's great to be able to have this opportunity back. As a sophomore, Clark competed in the discus at the Drake Relays and the state track meet. She was 15th at Drake and 18th at State. It's a great feeling to be at Drake where everyone there is really good and throwing their best. Clark said, I didn't throw shot much, but now I'm getting it down, and it's my favorite to throw. Clark enters with the second best throw in the discus and third best toss in the shot put. You face the best of the best at Drake. It's good to have someone to push yourself. It will be very competitive. I'm just thankful for God, my family, and friends, as well as coaches each day to be able to compete. Fear hit the Drake Relay stage as a sophomore and took 10th in the 400-meter dash. At the state meet in 2019, she was the Class 1A 400-meter dash champion while taking 3rd in the 800. She enters with the 12th best time in the 400. Manson Northwest Webster will send a pair of field events to Des Moines. Senior Lexi Wood enters 22nd in the shot put, and junior Janie Weiss has the 5th best mark in the high jump. Bishop Garrigan sophomore Audie Crooks has the 4th best throw in the shot put, and North Union's junior Samantha Nielsen in the high jump, and Green County senior Brooklyn Olson the shot put are also entered. With attendance limited this season, 8 hours of high school competition will air live on Thursday via Mediacom channel MC22 and a broadcast of the live stream on runnerspace.com. The Iowa Central men's and women's soccer teams ran into a tough Iowa Western program Wednesday at Rogers Sports Complex. Playing a third consecutive ranked opponent, the Triton men dropped a 5-0 decision to the number 2 Rivers. Iowa Western scored 3 goals in the opening half to gain command of the contest. They have won all 6 games to begin the season, including 4 shutouts. Following a 4-2 setback at Hawkeye, Iowa Central downed North Iowa area and Mason City 1-0 on a game winner from Christian Coffey. They also bounced back from a loss to Southeastern by beating ranked Iowa Lakes in overtime 2-1 before a 3-2 defeat at Marshalltown. The Iowa Central women had their 3-match win streak snapped, falling to the 5th-ranked Rivers 6-0. Iowa Western has yet to allow a goal in 5 matches this season. After opening the season with a 15-0 victory over Scott, the Tritons were tripped up at Hawkeye 3-2. They responded scoring wins over North Iowa area, Southeastern, and Iowa Lakes by a combined score of 12-3. Next action for the Tritons will be this Saturday when they host Indian Hills back here in Fort Dodge. The men's contest begins at 1 o'clock with the women to start at 3 o'clock. The Iowa Central women's basketball team will finally take the court Thursday at the NJCAA Division II National Tournament at Hickory, North Carolina. After receiving a forfeit win in the opening round, the Tritons will take on number 4 seed Johnson County, which advanced with an 86-49 victory over Grand Rapids. Tip is set for 8 o'clock Iowa time. Johnson County was the number 1 ranked team heading into the postseason before falling in its Region 6 championship game to Kansas City, Kansas. The Lady Cavaliers, 20-1 overall, received the lone at-large selection among the 16-team field. We've just been working on getting better each day, said Iowa Central head coach Brian Ortmeier. focusing in on what we can control and what we can practice. Once we knew McComb was out, we started looking at both teams that we might play. Iowa Central has played its best basketball down the stretch, winning 7 in a row and 9 of 10, including over Des Moines area to punch its tickets to Nationals. A key road win over Southeastern with the Tritons sitting at 4-7 overall helped spark the run. I look back at that trip to Southeastern as the turning point, Ortmeier said. We were facing a long trip and staying overnight in a hotel the night before. There were a lot of things that could deter our focus, but we threw on a press to try something a little different to get our kids more focused, more engaged, and we jumped on them 18-0. From that point, they believed they could really play defense, and that started it all. Ortmeier, in his first season as head coach of the Tritons, was named the North Central B District Coach of the Year. Isabel West, who has signed with Murray State, was named the ICCAC Player of the Year. She leads the Tritons in scoring and rebounding, with Nevaeh Galloway averaging nearly a double-double per game. Galloway was the Conference Defensive Player of the Year. Jordan Ingbrecht, Carly West, and Autumn Dykstra round out the starting lineup, with Nevaeh Mocher and former Webster City standout Taylor McKinney providing key roles off the bench. With Bell and Nevaeh, we know what we are going to get from them night in and night out, Ortmeier said. But just like the girls buying into what we wanted to do on defense, all of them having that confidence to step up and produce has made us a different team. When you have 3, 4, or 5 girls on the court that all feel like they can get the job done, you are difficult to defend. The winner between Iowa Central and Johnson County faces either Kirkwood or Illinois Central in the semifinals Friday night. Brett Miner knew exactly who he was going up against with a spot in the semifinals on the line Wednesday in Council Bluffs. Miner was one of 4 Iowa Central wrestlers to punch a berth in the Final Four at the NJCAA Championships, moving one step closer to securing a title. Joining Miner inside the Mid-American Center will be Keaton Geertz, Jose Rodriguez, and Jordan Pryor, all who helped the Tritons to 4th in the team race. Western Wyoming leads with 103.5 points and has all 10 wrestlers still alive on either the championship or consolation sides. Clackamas is 2nd with 95, Pratt is 3rd with 88.5, and Iowa Central sits with 83. Miner knocked off defending champion and top-seeded Blake Gonzalez in the 141-pound quarterfinals, earning a 4-3 victory in double overtime versus the Northeastern Oklahoma A&M wrestler. Just all about performing when the lights are on, Miner said. This is what Coach Luke and Coach Troy have trained us for. Against Gonzalez, it was just all about wanting it more. He was the defending national champ, and I wanted more than anything to knock him off. All the glory to God, and I can't wait to have some more fun Thursday. Miner had a fall and a major decision in earlier rounds and will face 5th-ranked Creighton Bauman from Iowa Western in the semis. Gertz, a transfer from University of Northern Iowa, earned a pen, a technical fall, and a major decision at 165, beating Jake Richardson of Clackamas in the quarters 12-2. He will face Seth Brossard of Rochester next. Rodriguez, a returning All-American, pinned his way to the semifinals at 174 and will meet 7th-ranked Navarro Nampuya of North Idaho. Pryor, a heavyweight, earned 2 falls and a major decision ahead of a bout with Curtis Ruff of Triton. Aiden Harris is still alive in the consolation side, reeling off 4 consecutive wins after a first-round loss. Harris will now take on Riley Weir of Labette. Yosef Yoma, Phil Smith Jr., Andrew Gambo, Jesus Gutierrez, and Hugo Harp all had their tournament runs end. Despite the chilly temperatures Wednesday, the Iowa Central softball team remained hot at the plate. The Tritons posted convincing 15-1 and 20-2 victories over Northeast here at Rogers Park in Fort Dodge, a week after sweeping the Hawks by a combined score of 43-5. Despite coming in having won these games with ease in Nebraska, first-year Iowa Central head coach Bo Jabin didn't take the opposition lightly. We told them that Northeast wasn't going to just give us these games, that we had to take them, Jabin said, and we had to come out and be aggressive at the plate, throw strikes, and play solid defense. I feel like we did all that throughout. The Tritons are 28-18 overall, remain in the top four in the conference standings, which would secure them a chance to host to begin regionals next month. They have won 8 of their last 10 overall, scoring at least 10 runs in 5 of those wins. In the opener, Abby Wilson was a perfect 3-for-3 out of the leadoff position with a triple and 2 runs scored. Peyton Crawford drove in 4 runs with Maddie Lang, Michaela Muir, and Allison Stewart recording 2 hits. Madison Huseman earned the win, striking out 3. Lang and Carly Thompson were among the many Tritons with 2 RBI in the victory. Kenzie Rosenblum hit a pair of grand slams in the second contest, finishing with 8 RBI. Layla Pelds also went deep with Abby Filgis, making her return to the lineup with 4 runs scored and 2 hits. Muir had a pair of hits, 3 RBI and 3 runs. Logan Schnetzer drove in 2. And both Thompson and Rachel Newell had 2 hits and 2 RBI. Emily English earned the win with Kayla Wookie striking out 3 over 2 innings. Iowa Central returns to action this Wednesday at Southwestern. A man charged in the shooting death of an Iowa State Patrol trooper was released from a hospital Wednesday and transported to jail, the Iowa Department of Public Safety said. Michael Lang, 41, of Grundy Center, had been recovering from gunshot wounds he sustained in a confrontation with law enforcement officers on April 9th in Grundy Center. Patrol Sergeant Jim Smith was killed while helping to arrest Lang, who was barricaded inside his home, authorities said. Lang, who ran for sheriff last year, was taken from University of Iowa hospitals and clinics to the Grundy County Sheriff's Office, where he made his initial court appearance. He has been charged with first-degree murder, attempt to commit murder, and assault on a police officer. Lang was taken to the Black Hawk County Jail, where he was being held on a $3 million cash bond. Governor Kim Reynolds implored Iowans on Wednesday to get vaccinated for COVID-19. However, she refused to acknowledge that slowing demand for the shots is greatest in Republican parts of the state or that there's a political aspect to the trend. After 43 of Iowa's 99 counties this week declined additional shipments of vaccine because of a decrease in demand, Reynolds promoted the vaccination effort by sharing the stage at her weekly news conference with National Guard Adjutant General Ben Correll, who is still recovering from a COVID-19 infection last winter. She also noted that Adam Gregg, Republican Lieutenant Governor, would be vaccinated later this week in Sioux City. But when asked about an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll from late March in which 36% of Republicans said they probably or definitely would not get vaccinated compared with 12% of Democrats, Reynolds questioned the validity of such polls. That's your poll, but I think we need to look larger scale and we need to really do a deep dive and really take a look at why, what's behind it. What can we do to help ensure Iowans that they are safe and this is the right thing to do, especially as we work to open back up and just continue to get life back to normal? Reynolds cited Kaiser Family Foundation research indicating that age is a factor in resistance to getting vaccinated, with the highest resistance among adult ages 18 through 39. These results likely reflect a sense of security among young adults who typically experience only mild illness from the virus and are generally less concerned about preventative care, said Reynolds, who repeatedly warned people to be proactive in stopping the spread of the virus, but adamantly opposed mandatory restrictions and quickly reopened businesses. Nearly 10.4% of the doses administered in Iowa have been to people ages 18 to 29, and that age group represents 25% of the state's confirmed cases over the past 7 days, health data shows. However, Kaiser studies also have consistently shown significant reluctance among Republicans to get vaccinated. For example, Kaiser reported in March that about 3 in 10 Republicans, or 29% roughly, and a similar share of white adults who identify as evangelical Christians, 28%, say they will definitely not get the vaccine. That study indicated 5% of Democrats and 9% of independents said they would not get vaccinated. Of the 43 Iowa counties to decline vaccines, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has identified 12 as having high rates of coronavirus transmission. Voter registration information shows that all 12 are heavily Republican counties. Reynolds said she plans to ask respected communities and religious leaders to encourage vaccine resistors to change their minds and get immunized. This shift isn't unique to Iowa. Vaccine hesitancy is beginning to become a real factor across the country, she said. CDC data shows that Iowa has fully vaccinated 920,481 people, or 29.2% of its population. That is the 15th highest rate of any state. We'll go ahead and take this date in history. Talked a little bit about this earlier, but on this date in 1970, the first Earth Day was held, an event to increase public awareness of the world's environmental problems. It was celebrated in the United States for the first time on April 22, 1970. On this date in 2004, Pat Tillman, who played in the NFL, was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan. In 1778, John Paul Jones leads American raid on Whitehaven, England. In 1978, the Blues Brothers make their world premiere on Saturday Night Live. In 1886, seduction is made illegal in Ohio. In 1992, sewers explode in Guadalajara, Mexico, killing hundreds. In 1954, Joseph McCarthy begins hearings investigating the U.S. Army during the Red Scare. In 1997, Peruvian President Fujimori orders assault on Japanese ambassador's home. In 1994, on this date, former President Richard Nixon died. In 1889, the Oklahoma land rush began, and in 1915, in World War I, Germans introduced poison gas. Also in 1915, the Second Battle of Ypres began. And on this date, in 1945, Adolf Hitler admitted defeat. That's just a sample of things that happened on this date in history, April 22nd. We'll go ahead and grab today's weather forecast for the next 7 days or so. Again, having a very pretty Thursday in Fort Dodge. On Friday, we'll have a high of 59 with a 40% chance of rain showers. Friday night, we'll have a low of 39 under mostly cloudy skies. Partly cloudy Saturday, high of 56, 34 degrees for a low Saturday night. Sunday, mostly cloudy, high of 63. Sunday night, a low of 49. Woo! Look out Monday, mostly cloudy, but a high of 80 degrees. Monday night, a low of 55. On Tuesday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Expect a high of 76 degrees. Tuesday night, 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms, a low of 49 degrees. Chances of rain continue on Wednesday under mostly cloudy skies. There's a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high temperature of 61. So for the most part, temps and weather looks pretty good for the next few days at least, and then we'll turn around first part of next week, so I'm sure the farmers are hustling to get as much of their fields planted as possible with what sounds like some rain moving in. Anyway, that's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger, with a little help from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal and the Marshalltown Times-Republican. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. Thanks again for spending this time with me. I do appreciate your company. Of course, this podcast and many other awesome podcasts are available to you at iowaradioreading.org. And it's a privilege, and I enjoy so much bringing to you the Fort Dodge Messenger here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Stay safe, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.